members of subcommittee of the Joint Committee of Ways and Means, and this is Wednesday, May 11th, 2005. We're here for a public hearing on House Bill 5029, which is the budget bill for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5029. Mr. Siebert, will you please recap for the other member of the committee what we're going to do on the agenda today?
Madam Chair, member of the committee, we're going to the director is going to come up and discuss the prioritization that the subcommittee went through of the agency's programs and continuing discussions on the performance measures. We've been meeting with the agency to try to get some finalization of the changes that were recommended by the co-chairs and the members of the committee. So he will be recapping that, and then we'll move into budget detail, starting out with Lisa Pearson from Budget and Management Division of Department of Administrative Services, recapping the governor's recommended budget, and then Captain Bruce Karen and Ed Bowles and Ron Anglin will come up and talk about game enforcement, the Fish Division, and the Wildlife Division.
Thank you very much. Mr. Director.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The first items I'd like to go over today are items from phase one of our presentation, which are the prioritization of budget programs. We agree with the phase one recommendation and what was presented at phase one of our prioritization process. I also have information that was requested by the committee from phase one that has been given to the committee back in February 23rd, and there were also questions that the committee requested be answered that were provided to the committee on March 8th of 2005. If there are any questions, I entertain those now.
Is this the material that we're getting? Committee members, if you don't have time to go through this at this time, this is also a hearing that will be continued to tomorrow. Okay. So we could raise any issues also in the beginning of tomorrow's session.
And this information was given to you on February 23rd and March 8th, so that it was some time ago when you first received it.
We have seen this.
Yes.
Questions or comments? Let's proceed.
Okay. There was also.
When you say this, like, you know, we're going to cut somebody open, you know.
Also, during phase one, there was a discussion about performance measures of the agency, and there were recommendations by the committee for modifying or creating new performance measures for the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Mr. Siebert is handing a copy out to you of our modified performance measures, and I also went around to committee members earlier this week and gave them a copy so they could have an opportunity to review our proposed performance measures. With that, I'll go over the performance measures. There's a face sheet that has Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife performance measures at the top. I do want to bring to your attention that there are two performance measures that we have not brought forward today, but we will, during this next biennium, have those performance measures prepared for presentation at the 2007, and that's number 12, which is new habitat measure that would not begin until next year, 2006. Would measure the amount of habitat in acres and or stream miles that is enhanced or maintained. And that will be commensurate with our comprehensive wildlife strategy that will be completed under guidelines from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We will also be working on performance measures respective of customer satisfaction. Deputy Director Chris Kautz was on the work group and committee that developed guidelines for customer satisfaction, so I feel very comfortable that we have first-hand knowledge is what's expected of us there, too. We'll get that out. going back to the performance.
Just as a matter of interest, Director Ball, in the discussions that we had with OWEB, they were developing a performance measure that sounds like your performance measure 12 with reference to their federal partners. So it may be worth having a conversation with them about data gathering.
We will do that. We will make sure that that occurs. First performance measure that I'll brief the committee on today will be the percent of licensed flying population respective of hunting licenses and or tags. Please note from the graph that we have not met our expected target. In fact, the data shows we are falling below the target line, are in a declining trend of licenses sold per population of Oregon, and in 2005 we'll make a readjustment of that target on our data, with respective of our data. This is not something that's uncommon to Oregon. I'd like to inform the committee that we have seen this in other areas of the United States, and in generally this is a similar pattern across the U.S. And I think it's most telling when we saw an influx of people into Oregon from the early to late 90s. We saw a population increase of about 800,000 people during that time, and we did not see a commensurate rise in level of licenses sold. So I think there's something that is taking place in our society with respect to hunting and also with our demographics. Most of us in this room are members of the baby boomers, and that is quite a bulge in the population. And that, when I and maybe some of you were participating in hunting and fishing in our early years, there was a greater number of people entering that recreation activity. As that bulge in age class came through, we've seen a resulting slip in the people that are coming into hunting and fishing activities.
These numbers are a percentage of the state population. Are you seeing the actual number of hunting licenses sold go down as well?
Hunting licenses in Oregon are somewhat stagnant. They are dropping some, but not as what you might see in other states nor in the United States either. Hunting licenses in Oregon are fairly stagnant.
Madam Chair?
Senator Bates?
The population that's buying hunting licenses, is that aging with the rest of the population, or are we seeing a kind of a thing going through there as the hunting population ages, we're going to see a drop in the number of people hunting? Do you have any idea what that population looks like?
The population size with respect to who's buying the licenses?
The age of the people hunting, demographics.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, the age of the people buying hunting licenses is relatively high. You're going to find most people who buy hunting licenses are older than 45 years of age.
Has it always been that way, or is the age of the is the age aging with the population?
The age of people buying hunting licenses follows the same track of the baby boomers.
So it's the same group of people as they move through the measuring.
Madam Chair, what I'm trying to get to here is as this baby boomers age, are we going to see a real drop in the not only the percentage of people who stay hunting, but a drop in the actual numbers finally, too? I mean, kids now grow up in a different world than I grew up. When I grew up, I was 11 before I saw my first television set. That's how old I am, okay? So we fished and hunted and ran around the woods. Kids don't do that anymore.
Not until 1930.
Yeah, well, where I lived, our first TV, I was 11. It's a big deal. Two channels. But the world's changed dramatically, and that's affecting this. And now we got kids who are obese. They're not active. They don't do anything except watch TV and play video games. And that's a big change in our society.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, I was going to mention at the conclusion of the angling license performance measure, I think you have led me to that point. Now, when you look at this agency, I would say in 10 years, you're going to start to see a downturn in revenues from hunting license and angling license sales because of the age out of the baby boomers. There's no other way that I can predict but a negative imbalance with respect to revenue generation. And it's simply going to be because that baby boomer group is going to age out. And as people get older, of course, they pass away or whatever, or they become disinterested or are no longer capable of participating in these type of outdoor activities. And that's going to be a challenge, I think, for the policy leaders and policy makers in the state. How do you adequately fund this Fish and Wildlife Agency? And that's something that we're going to have to cross. Planning for it now is better than waiting. We are taking a look at some demographic issues as well as cultural diversity issues with respect to hunting and fishing, so we can start forecasting with more accuracy as to what will happen here in the next 10 to 15 years. It's a challenge for us, and I think the more information that we give our legislators and our leaders in the executive branch of government, the better decisions we can make today for tomorrow. So we're looking at our demographics, cultural diversity issues, and we may be coming forth in future bienniums with some solutions.
That is interesting, too, in light of the fact that Measure 66 expires at about the same time.
Yes, 2014 on Measure 66.
That'd be a good place to go and get some of that.
But it is an issue, and I'm glad you raised that for discussion, Senator. I think it's one that has a lot of merit for future discussions.
Okay. Yes, we got to charge them for viewing animals. That's the next deal.
That's right.
Second performance measure is percent of license buying population with angling licenses and or tags. You'll note in the graph the data depicts a rise in license sales in the year 2001, and since that time you've seen license sales trail off in Oregon with respect to per capita basis.
Is this the same thing that's driving the decline, or is this an availability of opportunities to catch fish? What's going on here?
If you take a look at data that's been available with respect to fishing opportunity, we feel that the rise in 2001 was a result of availability of salmon opportunity in the state of Oregon. Steelhead and salmon are king in the state of Oregon. I mean, if you take a look at across the board, that's what attracts a lot of anglers. Not to mention we don't have a lot of other opportunities in Oregon to pursue fishing, but salmon and steelhead seem to be the driver here in this state. We had large returns of salmon in 2001. In fact, if some of you may recall from previous presentations I've made before legislators, that's when we started to see a resurgence of coho in our coastal streams. We saw large populations of spring chinook as well as fall chinook, along with those resurgence of coho numbers. We've seen some of those populations start to tail off. Coho seasons have been cut from what they were previous by the Pacific Fisheries Management Council on the ocean side. We've seen robust populations of spring chinook up until this year. Some of our highest runs were still coming into the entering the Columbia the last 2 to 3 years. This year, the population has fell way off. But I think there's also another factor here we need to consider. The economy was in a downturn in 2001. People didn't travel for recreation. I think more people stayed in state to recreate. And I also think people had time to go fishing, simply because there wasn't the economic activity to keep people busy. And one of the leading causes of people to refrain from hunting or fishing is not having time. If they have the available time, they hunt and fish. And if you talk to people who have left hunting and fishing, they will tell you the number one reason why they don't anymore is because they don't have time. So I think there's a couple of things that we're entering into that, entering in as a factor to why do you see that downward trend. We still have robust populations of anadromous fish, both salmon and steelhead. Trout fishery hasn't changed appreciably. And you also we also have warm water fisheries as well as our marine fisheries off the ocean.
The trout fishery thing. I look at Diamond Lake and Crane Prairie. I would argue that with you. The two of the biggest drivers for trout fishing in the state were Diamond Lake and Crane Prairie, and they've both been devastated. So I'm not sure I completely agree with your assessment of trout fishing, but that's just me.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, I agree with you that Diamond Lake is not anything compared to what it used to be or could be in the future.
I'm going to go up there and help draw that thing down and fix it with you.
Nor is Crane Prairie what it used to be. And I think there are some things that we've been learning about Crane Prairie that we might be able to change the production in that lake in the future. We've still got a lot to learn about the exotic introductions in Crane Prairie and their interaction with the trout fishery. But there may be some things that we can do from a management standpoint that can temper some of that too.
Thank you.
Good point.
I'm sure. Thank you.
Moving on to the next performance measure, a number of unscreened priority water diversions. We are on track. That's indicative of the funding that we've been provided through the legislative process. As funds are placed in that program, we are able to put screens on the ground, and that number of unscreened diversions continues to shrink. The fourth performance measure is number of wildlife damage complaints addressed. We modified this to be specific to the wildlife complaints. One of the things that the committee recommended to us from phase one was whether or not the people reporting the wildlife damage were satisfied with the service that they got from the agency after the complaint was aired. Now, we haven't been able to accomplish that portion of this performance measure, but we have been able to identify the numbers of wildlife complaints and chart that out for you. We will be working on how we can evaluate whether or not the person phoning in the complaint or coming in person is satisfied with our service delivery. We just simply haven't had enough time there.
Senator Nielsen, did you have a comment? The smart remark?
We're just looking at this and realize that the 5,000 complaints almost every year from logged here, all from one person on the South Coast about bears.
He's still not happy.
Well, we can find out what the service evaluation is. Yeah.
Just down there and kill a few bars and get that things right now.
Moving right along here.
Performance measure number five was a challenge to determine what type of success we're having in our hatchery program. So we identified coastal coho, or hatchery coho, as a measurement tool to evaluate that program. And you can see from the graph that there are times when we have higher success and return from smolt to adult than at other times. A lot of that is related to environmental conditions, but I also feel that one of the things that we've learned in recent years is the interaction between hatchery releases staged at different times, different watersheds behave differently. Outmigration is more successful at certain times rather than others. And we have tried to complement our hatchery releases with the environment so that we can get the most return from those fish. And I certainly hope that we will learn more from our hatchery research center that is being constructed down on Fall Creek on the ALC system.
I spent some time looking at this because it is interesting how the returns ping-pong back and forth from year to year. And I'm wondering if you stretch the data back in time, would you see that same year-by-year variation?
Chair Morgan, you do. That's fairly typical of hatchery releases that we've monitored for the last 50 years. What you're seeing on this graph is not too different. I think we can become more consistent in some instances with getting adults to return by some of the management hatchery practices and management practices that we engage in. But I don't think you're ever going to get away from some of that ping-pong type of a graph that you see here in front of you, principally because of the environmental conditions that are changing out there.
Senator Bates.
Madam Chair, thank you. You know, there's so many interactions here you can't measure what's happening in the ocean. Work's being done inland, like what OWEB's doing and other people are doing to enhance natural runs and interacts with natural and hatchery runs. Do you have any figures that the natural runs that might show the same ping-ponging going on or not? Do you have a count you do of coves that come up and span not naturally and do body counts on those? Do you have any data on that you can correlate these two things with?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, we have that data. You're going to find that in wild production that smolt to adult in the wild, you'll have a higher percentage of survival than you will in the hatchery fish.
Madam Chair, follow up. You see the same kind of swings, though. You see ups and downs.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, yes, you do.
And is it the same years that are occurring also? That happens? Do they sort of match each other, shadow each other, or are they incongruent? Which way is it?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, you see all kinds. You'll see some lineup of those, but then you'll see the unexplained too, where a wild component will do much better than a hatchery component of the same species of the same watershed. And that's one of the things we need to understand, what it is that's going on in our hatchery program that causes that. Is there something with the fish specifically? Is it a behavior issue with the fish? I think we're starting to get back to away from that genetic issue that we've heard so much about with our genetic mapping and our hatchery programs with wild fish of the watershed. But I think once again, those unanswered questions are going to be a challenge for the science director at the Hatchery Research Center to help us answer those questions.
Thank you.
There is a lot about fish management that we don't know yet, and I think one of the key points that I've stressed before, and I'll stress again today, if we stop learning, that's the day that we are not going to be supporting our fish and wildlife resources in this state. We have to have that research component so we can continue to learn. Performance number 6 is personal income generated from commercial fishery landings. We looked at several ways to measure the economic values, because in phase one, the committee asked that we focus more on the economic values of fish and wildlife resources. One was just people spending money. One was how much money is spent on a product, like at a commercial fish dock, how much money goes to the fisherman alone, not looking at the rest of the marketing process that goes forth. And what we finally concluded on as a best measurement would be to look at personal income generated from commercial fishery landings. So that is actually income that comes to an individual that then generates general fund taxes and stimulates an economy in a community and beyond. And so the personal income generated from commercial fishery landings, as you can see, has been bumped up from our data points in 2003 and 2004. I think you're going to see those data points come down in future years. Most of the driver of that has been related to the good salmon troll seasons we've had in the ocean, the fabulous sardine harvest, and the record-setting crab harvest off our coast, where we've harvested up to 34 million pounds of crab this year. Record years the last 2 years on crab harvest that we haven't seen that before. Now, both sardine and crab fisheries are cyclic in nature. You're going to see a rise in the population, and you'll see that population drop off in future years. I suspect you're going to see a drop in crab in the next year or so. You will also see a drop in sardines in the future. Sardines are very cyclical. They crash and they don't reappear for a number of years. That's what's happened to the sardine off our coast. They're here now, and commercial fisheries are reaping those benefits at this time.
The next few performance measures are all related to personal income generated. Was the methodology the same throughout all of the sectors that you examined?
Chair Morgan, to respond to that question, I'm going to call upon our economist, Dr. Harry Upton. He probably cringed when I said Dr. Harry Upton. He likes to be called Harry. But Harry could...
Thank you. My name is Harry Upton. I'm the staff economist for ODF&W. Thank you, Chair Morgan, committee members. In answer to your first question, for the commercial fishery, it's a little bit different in that was produced as a result of SS and landings. Those landings produce personal income that's associated with processing, retail, wholesale sectors, and so on. The other three data for the other three performance measures comes from the Fish and Wildlife Service. This is associated with the national survey that's done every 5 years. This expenditure data is the basis of the economic impact estimates, including personal income estimates. And the expenditures have a direct economic impact on businesses that offer related goods and services, but additional impacts are generated from other sectors of the economy. And so in order to capture these impacts, input-output models are used, and basically the models define relationships among economic sectors. These relationships are used to calculate impacts at the national, state, or local level. So for an example, the purchase of a hunting knife, it'll impact the retailer, but in addition, there are distributors, wholesalers, manufacturers. There are suppliers to manufacturers, suppliers of the inputs used to make the knife. So the economy might be envisioned as a web of interrelated sectors, and the model is utilized to indicate the economic activity and personal income, the wages and salaries resulting from that activity.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
I'm
not sure we're comparing apples to apples, orange to orange, the way you've just described it to me as far as commercial fishing and the rest of it. Is commercial fishing numbers just on income generated by the fishermen themselves? Or is it the ripple effect also in the economy?
Senator Bates, Chair Morgan, it's the ripple effect as well. It's just from perhaps a different context in that the expenditures are really at the retail level in the case of wildlife watching, fishing, angling, and hunting. In the case of commercial fisheries, we're also going up the chain to retailers, wholesalers, and so on.
Okay.
So same principles, but just from a different context,
okay.
A different point in the economy.
Okay. Because what we're getting to here is sometimes a push and shove between commercial fishermen and sports fishermen, who gets the fish. And I want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, being fair to both sides.
And I think that that's a great point to make.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, one of the things that is hard for us to calculate as well, though, this is based on the sale and purchase of product at the dock. But there is also another component of income from commercial fishing generated by boats being refitted, gear being sold and such that's not calculated here.
That's not in this.
No. And we don't have an accurate way of getting that sale data into our hands.
Not quite the same. Well, excuse me, Madam Chair. It's not quite the same. We have to keep it in the back of our minds.
Right.
Close, but not exactly
right.
the same.
But it is involved with the commercial industry.
Okay.
Thank you.
Chair Morgan, I might add that the appropriate economic modeling associated with allocation between sectors is really involved in economic valuation and cost-benefit analysis. So it's also important that the right model be used in the right context. So these comparisons, I would agree with Director Ball that these comparisons aren't necessarily appropriate to make those allocation decisions.
Thank you.
Let's proceed.
Thanks, Harry.
Thank you.
Performance number 7, personal income generated by wildlife viewing activities. That has been fairly stable throughout the last 5 years, and this is calculated on a 5-year interval and is related to evaluation by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for each state in the United States. In other words, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service does this evaluation of performance of economic activity for each state in the U.S. Performance number 8, personal income generated by hunting activities, is once again compiled by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and delivered to each of the states. You can see that there has been a slight rise from 1996 to 2001. That, in turn, could be part of the economics, or it could be simply that people are spending more on different hunting pieces of hunting equipment, such as the one that comes to mind that I've seen in the last 10 years increase, or the number of four-wheelers that people purchase to go hunting with, and also the RV type vehicles that are being used compared to what you might have seen 10 years ago. So it is a changing landscape as to how people spend their money in hunting and fishing activities.
Having talked to a certain nephew of mine, I wondered, do they spend more time out there actually hunting or running around on the ATV? The all-terrain vehicle in the woods, and is there a corresponding increase in damage?
I've come to understand that running around in the four-wheel drive or the ATV is hunting.
Yeah, I mean, they never get near the dang rifle. I mean, you're
being
around in the woods.
Somebody might get hurt. I mean, yeah.
So
yeah,
just leave the gun at home, but that'd decrease the license.
My uncle did that one time.
It's a tongue-in-cheek question at one level, but it's serious at another level, in that if there's a lot more four-wheeling than just getting to a destination, setting up to do the hunting, there could be some damage in the woods that all these all-terrain vehicles
I think
do.
Representative Krieger's going to offer to take you out hunting.
To qualify your question or answer, it depends how many beers they've had.
And they will teach you, Senator, as you know, in hunter safety class, that alcohol and guns
don't mix.
It's good for the economy.
Right, Michael? You mean for the funeral directors? Is that it?
You know, I think the director is hiding from these comments.
The medical delivery community.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ma'am, it's work for the doctors.
I hate to ruin this conversation.
Please do.
I would tell you, one time my uncle went hunting, we hit his rifle, he was gone for a week and never missed it. So. I don't know what he was doing out there, but could we go back to 7 just for a second? That was wildlife viewing. Do you have any numbers about knowing that wildlife viewing is increasing in numbers or decreasing in numbers? I mean, there's no licenses you can count. Do you have any idea of what's going on there? Are more people, as a percent of the population, going out and doing birding or viewing animals? Is that something that's increasing in our population?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, if you take a look back in time, scale it way, way back, I think you're going to find that there are more people who are engaged in wildlife viewing type activities than what we've seen in the past. Example, we have somewhere between 1.8 and 2 million visitor days at our wildlife areas. Now, some of that's hunting, but there's a lot of that that takes place where people are just going there for outdoor recreation and to see wildlife, have a picnic or whatever. We run 1.4 million visitors a year at our hatcheries that people come to see the fish. They're not there to catch them. Yeah, hopefully they're not anyway. but those types of activities generate an economy. People that stop, for instance, at Reedsport after they've been to Dean's Creek to see the elk drive an economy in Reedsport. And the people in Reedsport recognize the value of that viewing area, elk viewing area, outside their community. Just as people down at Jewel Meadows or in that area around Jewel Meadows recognize that that is an income, an economic generator for them as well. So people do engage in wildlife viewing today in a manner that they haven't in the past. Another good example is the number of people that go to Bonneville Dam to watch fish go through the fish bladder and stop at the hatchery there as well.
Sea lions, too.
I think
I'm going to see the sea lions now.
Well, right now they're not in the fish bladder.
Today.
That's right.
That's because there's no fish there.
They take Wednesdays off.
Yeah. That's nice of them.
Personal income generated by angling activities has slid in a downward trend from 96 to 2001. Not an appreciable change, but it has changed some in Oregon. Yeah. Performance measure 10, which is the percent of fish species of concern that are monitored. We have a data point of 2005, and we will continue monitoring this performance measure in the future years, and hopefully we can match our data to our target, which is an increase in numbers.
Mr. Ball, go back to 9. With the closure of the Columbia and the shortening of some of the seasons offshore, both commercial and sport, do you expect, if you compared to this year's opportunity that anglers are going to have compared to last year, that number would probably drop significantly again?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, let's put the angling expenditures in perspective. From 96 to 2001 in Oregon is when we had some of the lowest returns of salmon and steelhead to the state. So consequently, our seasons were curtailed most dramatically. Those seasons started to rebound after 2001. I think you will see an increase in sales next year when we get the data point from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in 2006. I think you'll see from 2001 to 2006 an increase in expenditures. Point to make, take a look at aluminum boat sales that are generated from Oregon manufacturers. Boat manufacturers can't hardly keep up with the orders today, and most of that was driven by fishing opportunities in the state of Oregon. Some outside the state, certainly. But without fishing, I think you're going to find those boat manufacturers would not be making the sales that they are in the last few years or this year. So I anticipate in 2006, when we get the data point from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you'll see that to be an increase. If the populations of fish drop off, I think you're going to see a negative impact to that economy.
Please proceed.
Moving to performance measure number 11, percent of wildlife species of concern that are monitored. We've had data points from 2002 through 4. You can see that those have been fairly steady. We hope to increase the number of those species that are monitored. One of the key factors of this performance measure simply revolves around a funding opportunity. Funding for this is most of these species that are to be monitored are non-game species for which there is very little money in the state to to manage non-game animals versus your deer and your elk that we have tag and license sales for. I'm talking about all of your other small mammals, etc., that are not monitored. And I think if we have a stronger wildlife diversity budget, you'll see more monitoring occur in these population areas. It is an issue. We have people challenging the department with respect to monitoring specific species in Oregon. They have threatened lawsuits, etc., with respect to that. It is an issue that I think we will have to address in the future. That concludes the presentation on performance measures. Chair Morgan, if there are any questions, I'll sure entertain those at this time.
With reference to the performance measures for state police, will those be in these performance measures or will they be in the state police budget?
Chair Morgan, the performance measures for state police will be in state police.
Okay. Could we, I think we should also have a discussion about whether it would be reasonable to include them in this budget, because this is where we would be interested in those outcomes. But we can have further discussion on that in the work session and give the agency some direction in the work session.
We can easily include state police performance measures in our report to you. That's certainly not a problem. And I think, I believe Captain Karn is prepared to explain performance measures they have with them today.
Okay.
Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Going back to number four, number of wildlife damage complaints addressed. Comparing that with your memorandum, one of the questions that actually there were 768,000 trees potentially killed by bears. I mean, just that's 2000. I mean, excuse me, that's a. I thought Representative Kruger was kidding me. He's not kidding me about that.
This is very serious.
I mean, does the complaints really address actually the actual damage? I mean, should that be part of a performance measure? Is that too far out?
I don't understand what you're saying.
I mean, I don't know how you would. I guess maybe I don't. How would you quantify? I mean, you want less damage. The complaints don't really mean anything, rather than the damage. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, I don't make any sense. I might have to. Kind of wondering about where I'm going with this.
Well, Madam Chair, if there was decrease in damage to trees due to the efforts of the Fish and Wildlife, that would be a performance measure of what they're doing with effectiveness. If we're doing anything.
We just let it happen. It doesn't really make any difference. It's kind of like damage to salmon by the sea lions.
Chair, is this going to come under predator control of the ag budget or any other budget? I wonder if this is one of those overlapping things again. I don't know who has authority if you have bears damaging your tree crop, so to speak, as Representative Krieger does. Who's he turn to? Where can he get help? And does he go to ag? Does he go to fish and game? Does he?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, bear are a game mammal, and they are managed by the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I'll have Ron Anglin come forward to give you some specific details respective of program on wildlife damage.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Bears are, as the director stated, a game mammal by statute within the department. And within our damage statutes located at 498.012, we have specific authority given to landowners to respond directly to bear damage and cougar damage without a permit from the agency so that they can take immediate action when they are having damage. So the legislature has very carefully crafted very liberal ways for us to work with landowners to respond to damage that they're having, specifically with bear and with cougar.
Madam
Cinder shields.
Has anybody been tracking the damage done? I mean, 20 years ago, 10 years ago versus now?
Chair Morgan, Senator Shields. It's difficult to track in some respects in that a landowner, specifically for bear, is not required to report to the department once they've harvested a bear under damage. A lot of them have private contractors they work with. Wildlife Services responds to a lot of the complaints, and we get that information in some ways, but we don't have a real good annual reporting system to track that through time. The complaints that come directly to us, yes, we do have a good record of that, and we can show increases through time as the bear population in some areas has increased. Now, related to that, OFIC and State Forestry have done some other surveys to document bear damage on private forest lands and on state forest lands, and they have documented an increase in time starting on the north coast and extending down to the south coast of bear damage on commercial timberlands.
You're talking about my thing and I wasn't here.
Yeah, we were noticing that.
Quick, he's out of the room.
That was planned.
We waited till you were out of the room and started yakking, you know.
We'll give him a chance to get his questions all lined up.
Well, after Representative Shoffler.
Oh, I don't know if he can stand to wait that long. It would seem to me, Madam Chair, he's talking about sources of information potentially from two or three different agencies. Doesn't sound like anybody has pulled those together or coordinated them. So the best you can hope for is a few bits and pieces of statistical information and a lot more anecdotal information. And so it seemed to me somebody ought to be doing something about that, because right now we don't know how much the increase is. I didn't even know we had a number of the number of trees damaged at this point. You know.
Well, and there is a proposal on the table to do a study with a price tag on it of about $75,000. So that may be something that would be worth considering in work session.
Madam Chair, I happen to get here, if you don't mind.
Oh, is Representative Shoffler going to yield to you?
Balance of his time.
I did have Roy Elker from the Wildlife Commission on my tree farm to verify what was happening. And also, of all people, I actually got Jim Myron to come down. The guy on ATV and took him out there, and he was able to see how bad it is. And it's not just my property. It's adjacent stuff in Coos and Curry. The problem I have with the analysis is the $15 per tree. I've got trees that are 25 years old that are in the 15, 16-inch diameter that have been peeled last year that are probably worth $100 a tree. But the thing that I look at is all of mine's taken place in post-commercial thinning. Those are the leaf trees that at 45 to 50 years have that production. So I'm looking at my investment as a long-term investment for the future. And when I calculated mine, I ran mine out to 700 board feet to a tree, and then times the $500-and-some per tree that I would have gotten for it. And that's how I came up with $400-and-some thousand damage. So when you look at this, it really doesn't tell you that you've lost this potential that's going to generate dollars down the line. You know, it's just like if you pull all your carrots out of the ground with this long, they don't weigh very much either. But you wait 6 weeks and you got a big carrot and you can sell it. It's the same thing with a tree. So that is that number isn't even. I would imagine that Curry County gets that $11 million without even batting an eye each year, just Curry County. So that is not a very accurate analysis. I did talk to the federal people that did part of that. But you got to remember, I'm here, and right now they're eating me out of house and home.
What a sacrifice.
Well, you're up here making the big bucks, too.
Yeah, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Do deer and elk eat up nursery stuff and stuff like that? Do we have problems with that in the nursery business? Is there anything?
Chair Morgan, Representative Shoffler, yes, they can. It depends on the location of the nursery site and what the population of deer and elk in those areas are. In some cases, we have cooperated with nurseries and put up fences around some of the smaller nursery sites to exclude deer and elk. Generally speaking, we don't hear huge complaints from the nursery industry about that. It's probably pretty peripheral, and does not at this point in time seem to be a driving problem for them.
Senator Bates.
Oh, Madam Chair, thanks. This is an area I don't, the bear situation, I want to get a little more information on, because I'm not as familiar with that as others. I've had a lot of personal experience with elk, and, you know, you can move them, you can keep them off to a certain degree. They're pretty famous. I leave my gates open for them, and they'd refuse to go through the gate and tear the fence down next to the gate. That's just elk, you know, but you got to put your fences back up. It just, you know, drives you crazy, but they're not. They're, yeah, there's some real viewing opportunities and some colorful language too. And you know, yelling at them, they can go the other way. But the bear thing is a lot more difficult. Even if you know you're having damage from aerial viewing or whatever you're doing to identify damage, identifying the bears and getting them out of the area must be difficult. If you kill a few of them, others are going to follow behind. Is our bear population? It's getting larger in the states, significantly larger states, that we're seeing more damage than we used to see? Is it static? And if it is going up, what's causing it to go up?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, yes, the population has expanded in some areas, and it's probably been due to a combination of factors. We today are harvesting nearly as many bears, in some cases as many bears, as what we did 10, 15 years ago. Some of the increases that we're probably seeing in damage is because of a learned behavior. The sow will train her cubs, and then that's passed on down through the generations. We have liberalized spring bear seasons, trying to reduce populations in areas that we know we have high damage, but it's difficult to remove enough bears to seriously impact the population to prevent that damage.
Chair, do we have an answer? Do you have any answer from a management point of view how to lessen this difficulty, or lessen the problem?
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, we're trying everything we can at this point in time, which is to lower the bear population in those areas where we're having problems, and we're using every tool available to us.
Representative Krieger.
Madam Chair, when I had Jim Myron down, we came back, we had a conversation about, it's not the Department of Fish and Wildlife's fault, we had an initiative that took some of the main tools away, you know, the baiting, be able to run them with dogs, which you can target in certain areas by doing that. If you really want to impact, I think those areas that are receiving, I think, unacceptable levels. Landowners shouldn't have to put up with this. I mean, if a human being did this, you'd have them in prison. What you need to do is during the target period, sometime 1st of April through the end of July, you can't have one or two people in Curry County trapping bears. You need five or six, and you need crews that are removing the animals so the trapper isn't spending his time being a butcher. That's what's happening. They get a bear or two. They spend the rest of the day taking care of that animal. They can't get to their other traps and rebait. So you need a huge increase in effort for about a four-month period that's targeted to areas that have the proper H class of trees. And we know where that is, and all the forest companies know where those H class of the trees are and where the damage is. And the wildlife services people, they know where they are and where we have problems.
I'm sure, would you agree with that assessment?
Better.
Chair Morgan, Senator Bates, it certainly makes sense to target your effort in the area where you're having a high degree of damage and try to remove those offending bears. And that's how we typically deal with big game damage, whether it's through emergency hunts, controlled hunts, whatever, is we try and target an area and put the maximum amount of effort into removing animals either prior to or during the beginning stages of the damage problem.
Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
On another subject, I've talked with Lindsay about this before. We're talking about these budget performance measures, and I'm really kind of concerned that we're actually even touching sort of the, I don't know, it's the animosity or the sort of general distrust of the Fish and Wildlife Department. I made this telephone call. I have a telephone conference in Malala County, and I happened to mention that I thought that the Oregon plan for the wolves was better than the federal plan. And I didn't realize how uninformed I was on that issue but I got to thinking about it, and there's actually an underlying thing about the culture of your agency that some of my constituents are having some difficulties with out there. Why would they trust you over the federal government? That was kind of my just naive overview of this thing. And that's been weighing on my mind, and I've got to call them again tomorrow, so I'm going to see whether or not how beat up I get again on this issue. But it seems to me that there's, in the general population, there is this sort of some, at least some areas, there's a mistrust of what's going on with the agency, and that concerns me a little bit. So I don't know if there's any performance measure you can do, but if we do all these performance measures, and maybe we're not answering the whole problem.
Mr. Director?
Chair Morgan, Senator Nelson, one of the things I think you touched on, Senator, with respect to distrust of this agency, may be a factor of the topic, and that's wolves. And it has been promoted very strongly by some different interest groups that the wolf management be left to the federal government, not the state, that there should not be a wolf management plan by the state, only by the feds, since they are the entity that brought them to the experimental reintroduction in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. It's their wolves. Let them deal with their wolves. The state should not be engaged. However, this agency is responsible for wildlife management in the state of Oregon. And the commission moved forward with a plan to manage wolves that was passed last February. And I am of the opinion, if you take a look back in time, that the state can manage its fish and wildlife better than the federal government. And let me give you a couple of examples. The sage grouse was a candidate species for listing, but the states came together to illustrate that the bird was not at a level where it should be listed, so we avoided a listing. We had a Lahontan cutthroat that was scheduled to be listing, but the state came forward with a management plan to ensure that the fish was not listed. We had a Columbia white-tailed deer that was listed, and the state had a management plan to come forward with to manage that species to where it was taken off the list. We have coastal coho that will be delivered this Friday to NOAA Fisheries, and I think we have a very strong case to demonstrate the viability of that fish, so it would not be listed. So I think the state is much better at prepared at managing its fish and wildlife resources than the federal government. And in addition to that, and I think this is one of the things I think is very principal in the philosophy of fish and wildlife management, is that if you look back through time, fish and wildlife is the property of the people of the state, not the federal government. The Endangered Species Act was written to intervene when those populations came to a certain level that the federal government could take control of those species. But I still say that if the people of Oregon want to contact someone about a fish and wildlife matter, they get better service from the state than they will Washington, D.C. Nothing against my federal counterparts, it's just the mechanics of it. And we can disagree on issues with respect to what's in the plan or not in the plan, but members of the committee, I'm convinced that Oregon can do a better job of managing its fish and wildlife than the federal government can.
Senator?
I approached an idea that I have a large distrust of the federal government. I'm not really a hunter, so I guess I don't know that much about what you guys are doing, but I just... That's where I was coming from, but it just seemed to me that there's a real distrust of the agency, and
mainly the culture of the agency, and we've talked about that in several other committees here too, is that, you know, how do you change the mindset of an agency so it's really serving the people rather than being this hammer against them? That's my point. Is that should there be a performance measure saying, you know, we are actually serving the people here?
We are inserting the customer satisfaction performance measure in all the agency budgets, and hopefully that'll track how the people that are the constituents or the patrons of that agency view the services that they're getting. Okay. Senator Shields, you were next in line.
Sometimes I believe that perception, and I'm just responding to Senator Nelson at this point before my question, that perception is even greater than reality itself. A person or a group of people has a perception of a certain reality. It doesn't matter what the reality might be, but that perception, you know, can get them in a world of hurt. And I can see how out in rural areas there would be a real perception that fish and wildlife might be arrogant because they're the ones that are making the rules, expanding or contracting the seasons or this or that or the other thing, setting the fee structure, you know. And and I think the performance measures, therefore, are good because I come down to looking at every budget and every agency and saying, okay, they were asked to do this and this and this in maybe budget notes or legislation. Did they do it? Or did they think they were above the law? You know? And whether the director would agree with me or not, I don't know, but there are times when there have been some directives legislatively directed toward ODF&W which haven't been complied with for one reason or another. You know, and I think that can also affect customer satisfaction. So it's perception and reality and the delicate balance between the two that have me concerned.
Representative Shoffley, you're next, but I think that it is time to note that we have 1 hour left in the presentation and we haven't yet actually gotten into the budget detail. So if we're going to get anywhere near where we need to by the end of the session, we need to move along.
I'll be brief, Madam Chair. Okay, we're going to set up a plan for an endangered species wolf that's been reintroduced, crossing over on its own. We're going to have in that plan reimbursement, lethal take. When they take a non-endangered species, a domesticated animal, sheep, cattle, that's let's just assume that all happens, that's all correct. If you take that exact same logic and apply it to the sea lion, which is endangered, which it really shouldn't be, there's thousands of them, and they're killing another endangered species that we spent billions of dollars trying to save, and we can't kill those, and I'll just say kill those animals east of the Astoria Bridge. I'm telling you, it is so illogical. You use the logic for the wolf and apply it to the sea lion, and I'm telling you, it just does not add up for me. And if the state can do a better job, then the federal government should allow us, and I read in the papers, accurate, sea lions eat 10 salmon a day. I read there was 500 in the river. That's 5,000 fish a day. Now, I'm not attributing all sea lion, all the lack of run to just the sea lion, but if you use the same logic for wolf, you can take them lethally, according to our plan, for destroying a domesticated animal that's not endangered. For God's sakes, why can't we take an animal that shouldn't be on the endangered list anymore when it's destroying another endangered species? It just doesn't add up for me.
Well, and I'm going to take that as a rhetorical
question.
That's
what it is. Representative Shoffley, indulging me.
And what I'd like to do is we still have the state police measures to go through. But, Director Ball, I would like to commend the agency on the great work that you've done on the performance measures. I think that the work that the agency did helped clarify the discussions that went on during phase one of this hearing, and that this is a very good set of performance measures for the agency. So I thank your staff for the work that they've done on this.
Thank you, Chair Morgan. I appreciate that. Might I make one clarification, though, for Representative Shoffler?
Thank you.
And I think it's something that's important for everyone to recognize, Chair. The Marine Mammal Act
squared me away on that.
Thank you.
But, Madam Chair, he actually added to my argument, and he also informed me, and you may correct me if you wish, that these are excess males that are no longer in the breeding population that are primarily in the river. So they're really not even going to put a dent in the reproductive cycle of the sea lion. So we could get rid of them tomorrow, wouldn't put a dent in the population.
If they're California sea lions.
Right.
None of them are north of Frisco. That are males.
We anticipate the behavior of these animals in the past will be exhibited again this year. They leave this area. They will probably leave within about 2 weeks, migrating back to California for the breeding season, and we will be without sea lions probably in 2 weeks.
Oh, so it's Californians again, huh?
Migration.
They go home to breed.
We love to hate Californians.
Never changes.
They bring friends back.
So we can shoot Californians? How's sea lion to me?
Full white male.
Full white male Californians.
Okay, let's proceed and move along and ask Ms. Pearson to do the world according to DABS.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services, and you should have a document that looks like this in front of you, and that is what I will be working from. And this is a very brief overview summary of the governor's recommended budget. The agency will be following with detail shortly after I am finished. If you turn to page 2, there is a chart showing the Natural Resources Program Area and the different agencies in that program area. The left-hand chart shows the total funds, and the right-hand chart shows the general fund lottery funds. Fish and Wildlife is approximately 16% of the total funds and about 7% of the general fund lottery funds. The next four pages show different graphical looks at the governor's recommended budget. Starting on page 3, there is a view of the budget that's been proposed by fund type. The largest is other funds. About 85% of that other fund revenue comes from the angling and hunting license fees. And then the remainder primarily comes from charges for services and also from commercial licenses. The second largest category is federal funds. And that is federal excise taxes on hunter and angler equipment and boat fuel purchases returned to the states. There's also some money for the National Marine Fisheries Service for hatcheries and also from the Bonneville Power Administration. The third largest category is general fund, and then the fourth category is the Measure 66 lottery funds. This agency is one of the rare ones outside of the Watershed Enhancement Board that actually has capital Measure 66 in it. That's about $5.2 million in the governor's recommended budget, and there's about $2.7 million of the Measure 66 operations funding in the budget.
And if I could just break in here, Ms. Pearson, this is an interesting graphic to talk about the one of the major budgeting challenges for this agency, and that is that the federal funds and the other funds, which are by far the lion's share of the funding, don't roll up the way that general funds do. And so the percentage of costs, increases in costs that are being able to be covered by general fund roll-up don't come anywhere near to the actual increases in costs in the agency. And there is a continual problem, a biennial problem with trying to find the funding to deal with the roll-up costs in the agency, and most often we found ourselves in a position where we have to go for increases in hunting and fishing license fees. So paying attention, particularly in this agency, to the ending balance issue is very critical, because it's the ending balance that's available that the agency is very careful at keeping in place to deal with the roll-up issues in the subsequent bienniums.
If you turn to page 4, there's a view by program. The Fish Division is the largest of the program areas, about 56%, and that is primarily made up of the natural production and also the propagation programs, and the propagation program is where you'll find the hatchery expenditures. The Wildlife Division makes up 22% of the budget, and its primary components are the habitat and game programs. And then Oregon State Police is also in here as a program. It's really a pass-through to the state police of other funds from this agency for wildlife game and wildlife enforcement, fishing enforcement. And there is some Measure 66 lottery funds that goes to the state police for these kinds of activities as well. It flows from the Watershed Enhancement Board budget into the state police. That's also another agency that receives capital and Measure 66 operations funding.
Senator Nelson.
One of our previous meetings, we had some folks concerned about the Bonneville power monies, where it's coming. You said where it comes in. Where is it spent? Is it spent throughout this whole budget, or is it where is it spent?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it would be primarily spent on the fish division side.
Fish division.
Right.
I mean, I guess the concern was at that point there was some attorney's fees or something, and basically the ratepayers were paying time so they could sue them. So they were very concerned about that.
Those would be the fees that were part of the agency's budget for the Department of Justice for Attorney General consultations, and there was a portion of that that the governor directed be used to address the Summerstill issues.
I just want to know where that would show up in all this.
Director Ball.
Chair Morgan, Senator Nelson, there were no BPA monies used in litigation. That was all other funds.
Turning to page 5, there is another view of the governor's recommended budget by expenditure category. Personal services is by far the largest, followed by services and supplies and special payments. If you turn to page 6, there is a table with historical information as well as the governor's recommended budget for 2005-07 listed out there. Major changes over time include the carrying forward of special session reductions from the special sessions in 2002. Those were carried forward into 2003-05 and will carry forward from there into subsequent biennia. And these affected such things as landowner assistance for the deer and green forage programs, hatchery emergency maintenance, the Klamath Basin restoration work coordination, with the Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Restoration and Oregon Plan efforts. There was also some fund shifts or technical assistance shifts over to watershed councils and other state agencies, and also some hatchery fund shifts. In the 2003-05 legislatively approved budget, comparison to the 2005-07 governor's recommended budget, most of the changes that you will see there are, in fact, primarily related to the personal services roll-up costs that the chair alluded to. And the primary components are the PERS rate increase from the current biennium and also the flex benefits, and that's medical, inflation, dental, that sort of thing. If you turn to page 7, I won't go over the first bullet there because it's been discussed to some extent already, but there are societal changes, including demographics. There are also Endangered Species Act listings and the threat of lawsuits facing the agency. There's a declining groundfish population in the ocean. The agency has a rather broad mission. It's supposed to restore and protect the biological diversity while maintaining opportunities for fishing and hunting. And as we've alluded to earlier today, there is concern about the long-term revenue situation based on fees with the societal changes that have been going on. Turning to page 8, the governor's recommended budget investments include resources for the operations at the new research hatchery. It continues the coastal monitoring and Western Oregon stream restoration project. It stabilizes staffing by converting some long-term limited duration positions into permanent positions, and it also addresses staffing issues such as the available months on seasonal projects, changing temporary positions to seasonal for ongoing work, and also aligning classifications with duties and workload. And as you can see, I've listed there are a number of packages across the different program units. They all have the same number, so all of the stabilized staffing issues are in packages 140. and all of the other staffing issues are in package 160. Other investments include resources for the hydroelectric dam mitigation projects or settlement agreements, excuse me, and also resources for game inventory, habitat improvement, damage control projects, and research. Turning to page 10, there are a number of reductions in order to fit within available revenue statewide. And that affects such things as archival data for water right and flow issues, fish screens engineer, and also the number of months for salmon spawning surveys. There are also reductions to trout purchases and support for the Clatsop Economic Development Commission Young's Bay Terminal fishery. There's some reduction to wildlife habitat access and administrative support, and also to the upland bird program, and to interjurisdictional fisheries services and supplies. There are fund shifts from general fund to other funds using ending balance at the Cedar Creek Hatchery and a part of the Upland Bird Program. And then, as we've seen in some other agencies, the governor's recommended budget continues the Pacific Coastal Salmon Recovery Fund, Measure 66 Lottery Fund fund shift that was adopted in the 2003-05 biennium. That would be proposed to continue into the 2007-09 biennium, again, because of general fund constraints.
Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. On the shifting funds from the hatchery bird program to other funds, why are we doing that?
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, because of the general fund situation statewide that we were looking at in the fall, all program areas were told that they needed to look at reductions. And so this particular set of reductions really is based on that directive, that we needed to live within our means and that we needed to come up with reductions. You have seen some other reductions in other agencies, such as the Water Resources Department had a number of reductions as well.
So we're taking out of those programs, putting it into other funds to fill in where you cut due to those cuts.
Madam Chair, Representative Shoffler, actually what we're doing is we take the general fund out of this particular program. It went essentially to the statewide general fund pot that would otherwise be allocated out to, for example, schools. The other funds is what was left in the agency's ending balance that they hadn't asked for. What we said was, okay, let's use some of that instead of the general fund. The governor can use it elsewhere.
Chair Morgan, Representative Shoffer, to add to that, that's why it's so critical that we watch the ending balance in the agency. The ending balance is also an indicator of when this agency will need a fee increase, and we will have to charge hunters and anglers more money if that ending balance gets too low, because then we won't be able to fund the agency. And one of the things that occurs in the fund shift, when general funds taken out of the agency, we backfill with license and tag monies that are generated by the sale of licenses and tags to the public. We then bump up that fee increase sooner rather than later. So in other words, if we keep taking money out of the general fund, backfilling with other funds, I'm going to have to go to the public and say, give me a fee increase today rather than tomorrow. And the object here is to postpone that fee increase as long as possible.
Director, do you have any information that you could share with the committee about the amount of general fund that's been backfilled out of the agency over the last 3 years?
Chair Morgan, there has been, I don't have the document in front of me, I think my memory will serve me, there has been $8.8 million of general fund taken out of the agency. $3 million of that was backfilled with Pacific Coast Salmon Restoration funds from the federal government. There was an additional $2 million that was taken from the agency as a result of a loan to the deferred maintenance account, which was an operating cash account for us that we used for about a year and a half to get this agency jump-started from its financial state in 2001. And then there has been $3.8 million of general fund program that has been cut, that has been backfilled directly with other fund license and tag dollars. And if you take, so if you take a look specifically, what has adversely impacted the ending balance is $3.8 million.
Members of the committee, I ask you to pay careful attention to this information because it really is critical to the funding dynamic inside of this agency. By taking the license and tag fees and backfilling into what had previously been funded with general fund, what we're doing is just speeding up the cycle by which we have to go back to the hunters and the fishermen and ask them whether they want decreased services or increased fees. And it is just very integral and very important to the policy decisions that need to be attached to this budget. Senator Shields and then Representative Krieger.
Right. I understand what you're saying, Madam Chair, and I appreciate you pointing out how much general fund has been reduced. If I would ask you to go back to page 6, I'd like to put that in juxtaposition to the fact that since 1999, 2001 biennium, it looks like the full-time equivalent employees at the bottom have gone up. These are just the numbers, from 1,003 to 1,150. I don't know what all that means. I don't know what the programs are. I know it's small general fund. I suppose I spend too much time in education and human services where everything's general fund, and it catches your attention. But, you know, this is a time when we've cut a lot of budgets and cut a lot of personnel. And my own school, where I'm still on the board at Mount Hood Community College, is, you know, having to deal with layoffs and stuff like that. Maybe as part of that analysis that you're talking about, we can also have a discussion of, yeah, general funds cut, but full-time equivalents have gone up for whatever reason.
Director, could you comment on this?
Chair Morgan, Senator Shields, I can speak with specificity from 2001 to present. And if I recall correctly, in 2001 alone, we cut 170 positions in this agency. That's coming from memory. I don't have a document in my hand, but I believe that was the figure that of positions that had been eliminated from the department.
And if I'm not mistaken, that was the funding cycle where we did the reorganization of the department.
What was that number again?
Chair Morgan, Senator Shields, my recollection was that we cut 170 positions in this agency.
Full or part-time or what?
It just positions. I can't tell you. That's just the figure in mind.
Madam Chair, I'm just sitting here looking at the numbers, and I see under 2001, 2003, actuals 127.03, and then under 035, I see 1108 in full time, and then under the governor's proposed, it says 1150, and that doesn't look like down, that looks like up. And I just don't understand the discrepancy between the numbers you've given me and what's on this piece of paper in front of us.
Perhaps, Mr. Director, this would be something that we could get into at tomorrow's session and get you some detail on that.
Chair Morgan, we'll give you a personnel staffing level history for this agency tomorrow when we first arrive. We can respond to that. And we can explain what took place in 2001. If I recall correctly, we cut the budget by there were several million dollars at that time, and there were, I thought it was 170 positions that were cut.
But
well,
I
would like
Senator.
That in juxtaposition to her question, which talks about the general fund cuts. At the same
time. I think that it would be a good discussion to have tomorrow. But Representative Krieger.
Well, just go back and reiterate the fact that we took, $10 million last session, and we had to have the fee increase to replace that. At the time, I was thinking that if our natural wildlife resources and the beauty and our air and our water and all this is the thing we're going to advertise to bring people to Oregon that generates money at restaurants, lodging, all the sports things that people come and do and buy to have as little money from the general fund in there as we do, I don't think is appropriate when you think about how the whole state benefits from those resources.
And again, giving us the gong on the time thing here, let's go.
On page 11, and this is the final page, there is a revenue issue which is addressed in Household 2159. And I believe this is mentioned, it wasn't mentioned yesterday. Current law would send net proceeds from the sale of the old Portland headquarters, which is about $1.6 million, to the general fund. That causes problems because federal law requires the proceeds to remain with the state wildlife fund. So House Bill 2159 would amend the current law, and by doing that, it would preserve about $25 million of federal funds for the agency. And then there are numerous technical adjustments. I won't go into them here, but I will mention that there is one for state police funding. And with that, I will turn it back over to the agency for the questions. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, where's House Bill 2159?
I see it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I believe that is currently residing in the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Where is it? Is that what you asked?
Where are they? Some of these things that I just, I'm worried a little degree that we got bills we need to push back and forth. I know it's not your decision or mine that really don't have a lot of meaning other than these kind of fixes we got to make. And I'm just bringing up that I'd like to see some of the stuff rolling back and forth between the two legislative branches. Others may disagree with that. Things like this need to be fixed.
I agree with you that we can't put the people of the state of Oregon in the place where we have the potential to lose as much federal support for this program.
It's just silly stuff.
And the bill is in Ways and Means, having come out of the House Ag and Forestry Committee, so we're staged. We have a half an hour to go through the Fish and Game Division of the State Police, the Fish Division, and the Wildlife Division of the agency this way.
Chair Morgan, I'd like to call Captain Bruce Karn from Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division forward to present Dave. And Captain Karn, you might touch on performance measures related to compliance.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Karn, for the record, Captain of the Fish and Wildlife Division of Oregon State Police. The Oregon State Police will receive approximately $12.95 million from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife during the 2005-2007 biennium. The primary mission of the Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division is to ensure compliance with the laws and regulations that protect and enhance the long-term health and equitable use of Oregon's fish and wildlife resources, and of course the habitats upon which they depend. The Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division is the single enforcement entity designed by law to protect the fish and wildlife resources. The Superintendent of the State Police and Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife have formed a partnership through cooperative enforcement planning so that enforcement efforts of the division are directed toward ODFW's priorities and management goals. The Oregon State Police, because we are a police agency and part of a division of the Oregon State Police, all of our sworn members are police officers and therefore are empowered to enforce all state laws of the state of Oregon. We enforce fish, wildlife, commercial fishing laws, enforce traffic, criminal, boating, livestock, and environmental protection laws. We enforce laws directly related to the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds. And if I may interject here, that's our performance measure for our division is the compliance, percentage of compliance of anglers that are in compliance with the laws for salmon and steelhead, whether salmon and steelhead angling. That measure of the last 2 years, last year in 2003, we had an 87.6% compliance among anglers for salmon and steelhead. 2004, we've had an 89.1% compliance for the anglers and salmon and steelhead harvest. We also protect the natural resources, of course, and we respond to emergency situations. Enforcement of Oregon's fish and wildlife laws is one of the four key priorities developed by the public for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife at a series of budget planning town hall meetings held throughout Oregon during the spring of 2004. Some of the key issues, of course, that affect our enforcement is the continued use of emergency and temporal rules that are usually not printed in the synopsis when they come out that protect sensitive resources while maximizing recreational and commercial opportunities that lead to added enforcement presence. Limited assets also hinder the division's ability to meet a growing workload. Fish and wildlife enforcement capability is declining due to limited personnel. 25 years ago, in 1980, we had 125 sworn officers in the division, and this biennium and next biennium, we're down 120 sworn officers for our division. In addition to their traditional enforcement of fishing and hunting laws, officers increasingly are being asked to investigate natural resource violations in such areas as fill and removal, water quality and quantity, water pollution, and forest practices. I might say, as far as environmental laws, the last 2003 and 2004, we have issued over 300 citations and have put in over 12,000 hours towards environmental enforcement. On page 63, I'm sorry I didn't tell you where the table is. We're on page 63. The Oregon State Police Fish and Wildlife Division receives $12.95 million of funding from Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Of course, those are other funds which are derived from hunting and fishing license sales and tags and commercial fishing licenses. All of these concerns create additional demands for law enforcement to maintain Oregon's natural resources as a stable and equitable resource to ensure all anglers and groups have the opportunity to have a quality recreational experience and the opportunity to participate in a commercial enterprise involving Oregon's natural resources to promote jobs while ensuring Oregon is a desirable place to live. The future of Oregon will be determined by the investment we make in our children, our economy, and our quality of life. Within this vision, two of the six priorities identified by the governor stress the high value of enhancing and protecting our natural resources and that public safety is essential to our citizens. The Fish and Wildlife Division members play a vital role in each of these principles as we enter the 21st century. And what I'd like to say is that you probably have in front of you an enhancement. We had a proposed budget that has gone through the governor's recommended budget, and we have come back to the department, to Director Ball, and asked for an enhancement of approximately $394,000. We'd like to address that so you have an idea of why we're coming back at this late in the session and asking for that.
Please talk to us about why you need an extra $394,000.
I have with me today, I'd like to call the table, the director of our fiscal office, and that's Ken Weiss, and he'd be able to answer those questions.
Representative Shoffman.
On OPB, I don't know when it was, last week, they had Oregon Field Guide had one of your troopers out there on the snake, I think, and he'll go out for days and raft. And it looks like an ideal job at first, but apparently they catch felons out there hiding from the law. I just wanted to throw that in there because I thought it was fascinating, and it's money well spent. But my question is, the state police went in my office yesterday, and I think they came in talking to the big muckety mucks about $18 million. We're asked what could they get for $9 million. They said 45 officers. I think that's all on the highway, though. Is that in any way going to benefit your division?
Chair Morgan, Representative Shoffler, and indirectly, it kind of will, and what I want to kind of lead into is we had some vacancies this biennium. We went ahead and projected out the hours because of this biennium in particular. We've had a lot of movement within this division, transfers, promotions, etc. For example, in Arlington, we had an officer leave there in a lateral transfer position, and we tried to fill that position, and we had nobody to put in for it. Typically, if we have adequate staffing in other divisions, we can fill those positions. But because they're down so far, we don't have that pool, you might say, of applicants to fill some of these positions. So we rely heavily on recruit classes. And when you rely heavily on recruit classes, a lot of times those classes only come around when the agency has a need and has the budget to fill those. And so in some sense, their budget doesn't affect ours, but in some sense, them not being adequately staffed or having recruit schools doesn't help us.
I'm curious to explore the issues of the vacancies some more, but I would really like to get some input on what this $394,000 funding request is all about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ken Weiss. I'm the Budget Director for State Police. When we were beginning the process to put our budgets together, Fish and Wildlife was requesting some information from us on what the amount of transfer we would need from them. At the time, we hadn't completed our budget preparation side, so we gave them a 2.4 inflation factor. Once we got through our budget preparation stage, and actually it wasn't until we got into the governor's rec that we went back and did an analysis of the number of positions that are to be funded by Fish and Wildlife, did we realize that we didn't adequately include enough funds to cover merit increases and that sort of thing in the personal services side primarily. We visited with Lindsay and staff recently about the difference between the increased cost of 2.4% that we did give them and the percentage increase, which should have been about 5.61. So we're understated our needs by about 3.2%.
Is that an issue also in the rest of your budget?
It's, well, if I may, Madam Chair, our budget, we're heavily a general fund on a more general basis. We do have lots of unfunded costs that we have to incur. Now, this particular program, because it's a contract, we keep the positions that this program funds tied to those dollars, so we don't have any spillover of this program picking up any of our general fund costs. But it has been difficult to estimate reliably some of the costs. For example, although this isn't necessarily tied to the Fish and Wildlife budget, our fuel cost is substantially higher in terms of what our projections are versus what we were able to budget for, as an example. So we do have costs throughout our agency that is difficult to obtain funding for. But in this case here, it was primarily tied to the fact that we had merit increases that continued on in the 03-05 biennium and did not get funded. Then when PICS froze, for PICS is the position inventory control system that we budget the positions for. When it froze, we had several of our employees that were being paid higher than what the budgeted figures were for the current biennium. When we rolled these costs forward into the 0507, we found that we needed to increase our personal services costs about 6.56% overall. And again, we only gave them the figure of 2.4 for the entire contract. But the majority of that cost increase estimate was in the personal services side.
Madam Chair, maybe I can provide a little bit of clarification. The way that these dollars, these transfer dollars, are budgeted in the ODF&W budget, they're categorized as a special payment. And under budgeting rules, the department is only allowed to apply an inflation factor of 2.4% for any special payment without an exception. And to get an exception from budget and management, they would have to come forward with the reasons for that exception. So LFO believes that it would be pretty clear, based on the high personal services costs that that this transfer pays for, that 2.4% was not going to be enough to cover the roll-up costs, as they talked about, just benefits, inclusions of merit increases, and those types of costs. So it is something that needs to get done early in the biennium, but we believe that OSP should know, just as if they're building their own budget, that personal services cost increases will not be covered by 2.4%. They need to make sure that they get that information to the department soon enough so that they can go to budget and management and say, we need an exception to increase our transfer amount.
So what happened? Why didn't that occur?
The Fish and Wildlife Division's budget consists of several different contracts. We didn't realize that this particular contract was underfunded until after we had a chance to sit down with our financial manager and do a contract-by-contract analysis of what the true costs for each of those contracts would be. And that was just recently concluded.
So what have you put in place to forestall this from happening in the future?
We're going to sit down with the program, each program throughout our department, particularly the Fish and Wildlife Program, and make sure that we understand what the true costs are of the positions that are attributed to each of these programs. Again, they have a total of 120 officers assigned to the Fish and Wildlife Division, and 64 of them are attributed to this contract. And we're just making sure that we have a clear understanding that when we set up these program cost accounts, that we're accounting for each of those positions properly within each of those program cost accounts.
Thank you. And if you could just stay there, I'm curious also about the vacancies in the Fish and Wildlife Enforcement Division. And what I'm lacking is information about why those vacancies continued. Why were other officers not permitted to transfer into those positions?
Chair Morgan, throughout the biennium, it's not just Fish and Wildlife. Currently, we have 12 vacancies in our division. We have two at Marine Board, Lottery, six of them right now are currently in Fish and Wildlife Division. Out of those six, half of those three just came about in the last 2 months. So we've had a lot of movement in the division. The answer to your question about filling those is we attempted to fill those. We advertised some of those. They didn't get filled. What we did is we relied on the fact that, for example, McMinnville, we had about four positions that in order to fill those positions, we had to hold those officers back because the hole that they would have created to fill those, for example, McMinnville, we had an opening there due to a retirement, but the officer in Fossil, who was to get that position, if I was to vacate him early or let him go then, we had no protection of steelhead on the John Day River because Ardington was already vacated. Basically, North Central Oregon would be void of a Fish and Wildlife officer. What we had done, and we tried to attempt to hold those until April. That would give our recruit class, who would fill those positions, time to get through school, get through their coaching, and then be solo patrol. We go ahead and move those people out. We went ahead and moved those people out anyway in April. Those did roll forward. Albany, for example, received two. So we tried to fill those positions about a few months ago. We've been holding monthly meetings with Mr. Weiss in the fiscal department, and every month we go over the predictions towards the end of the biennium, and the predictions that were going to come out, and for example, for ODFW, by the end of the biennium, it looked like our balance wasn't going to be, we were running out of money, to put it bluntly, and so we held off pursuing filling some of those positions. In other words, we maintain current the personnel that were in those positions, but we didn't shift. Number one, there was nobody to shift to those positions because patrol, criminal, they have no people. But positions, say, that were already within the division, maybe on a lottery fund or another fund, we just didn't advertise because we couldn't bring those people on to that funding source, so we held those positions.
What happened to the funding that was attributed to those vacant positions?
Madam Chair, if I may, we went through it and did some analysis, and we determined that we had the equivalent of about eight positions vacant for the biennium that were funded out of the Fish and Wildlife contract. That generated approximately $1,065,000 of money we would not have invoiced Fish and Wildlife for reimbursement for because of the vacancies. However, we had other costs that we had to cover that were either unfunded or underfunded within that program that ended up consuming that essentially all but about $8,000 of that savings.
What was the nature of those costs?
Some of the examples there, I have a specific breakdown, but for the record, we had the increased flex benefits cost. This is where there were agreements between the labor and management to increase the cost of manager or employer-paid benefits. Of those dollars, if it's another fund account, we don't get money for that. We get expenditure limitation for that. We have to recover the money from our contract source. In this case, it would be Fish and Wildlife. That figure was about $182,000.
And when did you become aware of that cost?
Some of these costs, that particular one wasn't known to us until I think the e-board of about November or January, when DASC, Department of Administrative Services, came over for the increased limitation and how much money that the general fund, the PEB account, and the other fund limitations were. That amount wasn't determined until late into the biennium. We have incurred those costs from the very beginning, from the moment the increased costs went into effect, and I think that was early in the biennium, September, October, I believe. And if that answers your question, I have other examples. Other issues or funding issues that we were faced with this particular program, and actually these were are system-wide for our agency. We have an OSPOA contract. That's the labor group that represents our sworn officers. They have a non-strike clause, so any unresolved labor negotiations goes to arbitration. That process took us a year. We didn't get a decision out of the arbitrator until about June or July of 2004. So with the evergreen clause of that labor agreement, it says we continue to pay merit increases as scheduled. And again, the merits were stripped out of the budget from the legislative approved budget process, but it was a real cost that we had to continue to cover because of the labor agreement. That was one
so
of the.
So you had merit increases that you paid in the 03-05 biennium.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
There were merit increases that you paid in the 03-05 biennium. Then why weren't they included in the roll-up in this biennium?
Madam Chair, they are included. That's part of that 6.56% increase that I was talking about.
But I think I'm confused, because what I thought I heard you say was that you didn't include the merit increases in the roll-up in your original budget estimation to ODFW because you didn't pay them in 03-05, but I thought I had just heard you say that you did pay them in 03-05.
No, I'm sorry. If that's what I said, I misspoke. We did pay them in 03-05, and they rolled up into 05-07. So the cost was even greater.
Included in your original roll-up computation for 05-07.
Once, Madam Chair, once we paid those costs, they stay fixed to the employee, even though the budgeted amount is lower. So we had, when we did the 05-07 roll-up, the PICS took another snapshot, if you will, of what the employee is being paid and froze that salary as it projected into the 05-07, and that figure was higher than what was budgeted. So it gave us a higher figure that rolled up into the 05-07, if that makes sense.
No, it doesn't. In the interest of time, what would probably be a good thing to do here would be to have you give to Mr. Siebert a detail of the costs that you that were taken up by the excess revenue in the budget during 03-05, when you found out about those costs, what they are, what the amounts are, and then how you computed the original roll-up and how you computed the subsequent roll-up. And if you could get that detail to Mr. Siebert, that would be very helpful to us in understanding what's going on.
I'll do that, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If we, I think, move very quickly, we could get at least partway through the fish division.
Chair Morgan, I invite Ed Bowles to the table. Chair Morgan, I might add that throughout all of our town hall meetings and discussions with the public, Fish and Wildlife Enforcement has been a high priority with our public.
I understand that. I've been to a few of those town hall meetings myself and heard that sentiment expressed. I think the frustration that I'm feeling right now is the inability of the state police to be able to predict correctly the cost of their services. Mr. Bowles.
Good afternoon, Chair Morgan and members of the subcommittee. My name is Ed Bowles. I'm the Fish Division Administrator for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm going to present hopefully a brief overview of Fish Division. It's found on pages 37 through 50 of your Ways and Means document. I'm going to
that one.
The smaller one.
It's huge. We didn't want to take a chance on an OSHA claim if we moved this one.
I'd like to first stress a little background. Fish Division, if you really boil it down, focuses on two key areas. One of those is providing fisheries, and the other one is maintaining healthy native fish populations. And so everything I talk about will be geared kind of towards those two primary focuses. As far as the fishery side of it, Oregon sport and commercial fisheries are extremely important. As you're all well aware, the economics of these, the cultural recreational opportunities are very important to Oregonians. This isn't just in local sort of areas, but really statewide. The footprint is very broad, but it also provides a good opportunity for money to flow, I guess, from somewhat urban settings into these local river, coastal, and lake communities as well. And so it's very, very vital to Oregon's economy. Now, as far as maintaining healthy native fish populations, this is very important, not just because it's the foundation for the fisheries, but it's also kind of cornerstone for ecosystem health. It's also a key element, as you're well aware, in this era of federal ESA listings and other sensitive species listings. It allows the state of Oregon to maintain its authorities over management of not only the fish, but also water and land. And this sort of a success in trying to meet these two objectives really requires balance, and balancing the needs of the fish with other societal values. But equally important is a strong monitoring and evaluation program that can really allow us to listen to the fish and gauge their success in meeting their minimum needs so that we can adjust programs accordingly over time. And Director Ball mentioned that as well. Now, in order to accomplish these two objectives, or the investment of the agency is quite substantial in Fish Division. As Lisa mentioned, there's over 70% of the FTEs within Fish Division. We've got nearly 60% of the expenditures, so it's a very big program. I would mention, though, that the majority of those positions are field-oriented. We've got over 94% of the positions are associated with those field activities, only 6% actually headquarter-oriented. Now, we've got four primary program areas, propagation, natural production, the marine program, and what we call our interjurisdictional fisheries program. I'm going to go through each of those briefly, and you can stop me when you want, Chair Morgan, on that. As far as propagation, most of you are aware, hatcheries have been a very vital part of the state's fish management really since the late 1800s. We've got 33 hatcheries, 21 satellite facilities, 25 step propagation facilities. So all told, these produce over 38 million salmon, steelhead, and trout that are released each year. So substantial numbers. Now, this program also includes all the fish marking that we do, which is quite extensive, fish health monitoring, engineering, and also tracking the pollution abatement and water quality associated with all these facilities. As a, I guess an interesting note, of course, we don't manage our hatcheries to be tourist attractions, but they are. We enjoy over 1.4 million visitors every year to these facilities. And, you know, obviously there's the good educational benefit of that. exposing them to our programs and to these fish. And when you connect people with fish, you're also connecting people with preserving those fish. But it's also great for just family outings, for picnics, and I would mention it's all free of charge at this point in time. So our natural production program is very important both for the fishery side of our mandate, but also the conservation side of it. We've got 10 primary functions that are lined out on page 38 of that short version. I'm only going to focus just on about half of those. I'd like to start with the Restoration Enhancement Program, what we refer to as R&E. This is really funded based on a surcharge on our licenses and poundage fees. It's both sport and commercial. And this really goes to help out with fishery management in a nutshell. We've got over $3.5 million this past biennium that went towards hatchery improvements, watershed enhancements, angler access, education activities. We've got fish passage projects. So there's lots of benefits to fisheries that this is supporting. Another program is our research program. This is kind of behind the scenes, but very vital to the success of our programs. It has extensive monitoring, not only of the fish, but also of their habitats. We investigate specific questions as well as just track kind of a backdrop of how the fish are doing. This really helps focus the restoration activities that are supported through the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds and other efforts. It allows us to keep those high priorities and best bang for the buck. Also, this information, as Director Ball mentioned, is very vital to us in keeping fish from getting to a point where they need to require federal protections, so listings. One other new kid on the block, if you will, under the research side is the Hatchery Research Center. And we're very excited about this. I'll talk about that just a little bit later, but it's just a good example of the legislature and ODFW's leadership in trying to bring really good information to the hatchery and wild fish debate, as well as moving forward on responsible use of our hatcheries, not only in conservation, but also in utilization of fisheries. So, screening and passage, another key program area. Funding and technical support to reduce both impacts from diversions and barriers. It's kind of a cost-share program. This past biennium, there were over 100 screens installed. One thing I'd like to point out is that that isn't quite picked up on the performance measures is that this past biennium, we really focused on some of the larger diversions, and so a lot more water being screened. And we've had over 3,000 cubic feet per second screened this past biennium, and that's a five-fold increase over any other biennium. So very substantial effort by those folks. If I could, I'd like to just highlight one particular project that I think really demonstrates the kind of cooperative spirit that goes into the screening and passage program, as well as the connection with the landowners. And this is on the Shewakan, the Narrows Weir project by Paisley. And it's just really remarkable because you had basically the district biologists on the ground with the local landowners really coming up and instigating the idea of trying to move forward on this. We basically had a screening and passage program jump in and design the project. You had R&E as well as OWEB come forth and fund the project. Then we had our screen shop construct it, and everything coming together remarkably to get this done. And local, very strong local support. In fact, just last week, local there saw a native red band in the ladder, and so called up very excited about this. So it's working. Now this has opened up over 50 miles of high quality area for these native red bands. Tremendous opportunity to enhance the trophy trout fishery there, not only Paisley but also Lakeview. So good.
I'll control good myself. Okay.
All right.
Stay away from there.
Madam Chair, yesterday, actually, in your absence, we had a gentleman from the watershed who is a cattle rancher there, participated in this very project, came forward and actually gave us a very nice color chart describing the entire project and how well is. And understand now that they're also opening up a little more. They're talking about going, the watershed is extending this effort downstream, I think.
Chair Morgan and Representative Krupp, we're also looking at Red House Weir and the Paisley Town Weir, but all told it'll be about 50 miles. So, okay.
It's a great project.
Mr. Bowles, we're at the end of the time that we have allotted for this, so with your permission, we'll break here and invite you to come back tomorrow and finish up.
You have my permission.
Thank you. And with that, there's my question. I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5029 and adjourn the committee.